Welcome to episode 1489 of the 1010 Thrive podcast, brought to you by 1010 Thrive Ministries. 1010 Thrive, 10 minutes a day, based on 10 guidelines for abundant living. In the previous episode, Salome told us about the last time she saw John. Knowing that the distance opening between them would not close again in this life, she told her son what she most needed him to hear, that she was proud of him, not simply for the gospel he had written or the ministry he had carried out, but for the man he had become. In releasing him, she finally understood what Zebedee had understood decades earlier beside the Sea of Galilee. Some of what parents pour into their children is not meant to remain with them. It is given for whatever those children have been called to become and for the people their lives will eventually touch. Salome then reflected on her own place in the story. She had no apostolic title and left behind no gospel, letter, or recorded sermon. Yet she had followed Jesus through Galilee, remained near the cross, gone to the tomb before dawn, sat beside James in his guilt, endured his martyrdom, and watched John carry his calling beyond her reach. Her contribution was the faithfulness of presence, standing at the edges, keeping her eyes open, and refusing to look away from the people she loved. Now John takes over in telling his own story, Acts of the Apostles, Part 6, Chapter 9.
I am the last one. I do not say this as a complaint. I say it as a fact, because I have learned on this island that the difference between a fact and a complaint is everything, and that one of the tasks of very old age is learning to receive facts without immediately converting them into something that requires a response. I am the last of the 12. Peter is gone, crucified in Rome, upside down as he asked. Andrew is gone, on a cross in Patras. Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew. Thomas has been in India these many years and will not come back from it living. My brother James was first of us all, 40 years ago now in Jerusalem. And I am here, on a small island in the Aegean, breathing the sea air, waiting. My mother told you who I was. I heard her. Not literally. She is gone now, has been gone for some years, and I carry her the way I carry all of them, which is to say always and in every room I enter. But I know what she said, because I know her, and I know what she always saw in me that I could not see myself. She was right about most of it. I want to tell you what she could not tell you, what it looks like from the inside. I was sent here under Domitian. The Romans have a long history of dealing with inconvenient people by putting distance between them and wherever they might cause trouble, and I had become, apparently, inconvenient enough to warrant an island. Patmos is small, a few miles long, less than that across at its narrowest. Rocky, the soil is thin and the wind is reliable, and the people who live here have the particular quality of people who have made peace with limitation. Not defeated by it, exactly, but shaped by it, the way stone is shaped by water over a very long time. I have come to love it. That surprised me. I thought I would find exile difficult in the way loss is difficult, a subtraction, a diminishment, the taking away of what had been. And in some respects, it has been that. I am far from the communities I have spent decades building. I am far from the people who know me as something other than an old man on a rock. The work I could be doing, the visiting, the letters, the teaching, the settling of the disputes that are always arising in young communities that have not yet learned how to hold disagreement without fracturing. That work is happening without me now, and I am here instead. But the island has given me something I did not know I needed, and which I could not have received any other way. Silence. Not the silence of absence. The island has its sounds. The Aegean is never quiet. But the silence of reduction. The noise of ordinary life, the needs and questions and demands that a community generates around its leaders, the constant requirement to respond, all of that has been removed. And what I find in the space it left is not emptiness. What I find is what was always there underneath, the thing I have been holding since the first afternoon on the Jordan, still present. If anything, more present now that everything else has been stripped away. The visions began on the Lord's Day. I will not try to explain them. I have already tried in the book that is being written, and what I have written is as close as language can come to what was given, which is not very close at all. Language was built for the world it describes, and what I saw was not entirely from that world, and the translation is imperfect in ways that frustrate me, even as I accept that frustration as the nature of the task. What I can tell you is what they felt like, not what they looked like. That is in the book, what they felt like to receive. My mother said I was always the one who went quiet when something had real weight in it, who looked at the middle distance and held the thing until it revealed what it was. That is accurate, and I have been doing it my whole life. And what I found on this island is that when you have been doing something your whole life and everything else is removed, the thing you have been doing becomes very large. The visions are not frightening. I want to say that because I know the book I am writing contains images that alarm the people who first heard them. The beasts, the seals, the judgment, the catastrophe. I understand why those images alarm, but they did not alarm me in the receiving, because I knew what was underneath them. I had held the thing they were expressing since the cross, since the empty tomb, since the first morning and the charcoal fire and all of it. The visions are not adding something new. They are completing something that has been trying to complete itself since the first afternoon on the Jordan, when Andrew and I followed a man who turned around and said, "What are you seeking?" He is still asking. That is what I want you to understand about the visions. They are not a departure from everything that came before. They are its fullness. They are what the beginning was always moving toward. In the beginning was the Word. I wrote that. I know what it means. I held it for decades before I wrote it. And the Word is still speaking. And what it is saying at the end is not different from what it was saying at the beginning. It is the same voice, the same love, in new and terrible and glorious form, because the world is in new and terrible and glorious need, and the love is equal to whatever the need requires.
Write what you see in a book, and send it to the seven churches.
My brother was the first of us to die for it. I have thought about James every day, since the morning Salome came to us with the news, every single day. Not with grief only. The grief has had 60 years to become something more complicated than simple grief, and what it has become is something closer to gratitude. James said yes to the cup. He said yes before he knew what the cup was, and he said yes again when he understood it completely, and at the end he kissed the man who condemned him and said, "Peace be with you." My brother, I knew him before he knew himself, which is the thing brothers know that no one else does. I knew the fire before it had a direction. I watched it find its direction, and then I watched it pour itself out, all the way to the last drop, and I have been living in the light of it ever since. I am the last one. I am on an island, and the visions are coming, and I am writing them down as faithfully as I can. I do not know how much longer I will be here. That is not my business. My business is to hold what I have been given and transmit it as faithfully as the holding and the language allow. The light shines in the darkness. I wrote that. I believe it. And on this island, at this age, having seen what I have seen, I am the evidence for it.
There are seasons of discipleship defined by movement, and there are seasons when faithfulness means remaining where we did not choose to be. John had spent decades preaching, teaching, traveling, caring for people, and strengthening churches. Then exile took much of that activity away. Yet Patmos did not take away his calling. When the familiar work was stripped from him, John discovered that God was still present and still speaking. The place that appeared to interrupt his ministry became the setting for one of its most enduring expressions. We often measure usefulness by what we can accomplish, where we can go, and how much influence we can exercise. John reminds us that God is not limited by the limitations placed upon us. An island can become a sanctuary. Silence can become revelation. Waiting can become ministry. Even circumstances that appear to reduce our lives can create space for us to hear what constant activity once made difficult to hear. And through everything John sees, one conviction remains unchanged. The light shines in the darkness. He believed it when the tomb was empty, when James was killed, when friends and fellow apostles died, when churches suffered, and when Rome sent him into exile. Christian hope does not deny the darkness. It declares that darkness is never ultimate. Our calling, like John's, is not to control how long we remain or what circumstances surround us. It is to receive what God gives us, remain faithful to what we have seen, and bear witness to the light for as long as we are given breath. To be continued.